I understand these sessions are being recorded, so I need to say that I am Richard Swanson, and I hope it's the 16th of June, or I've lost complete track. And we are working on creation stories. We're going to be working all this week on particularly three creation stories. The story in Genesis 1, the story in Genesis 2, and the story that kicked them into being. We will look at that story that kicked them tomorrow. We'll look at that rather closely. But I want to start today just thinking a little bit about what stories do, because we are in fact working with stories, and if we don't do some preliminary thinking about the function, the nature, the structure of stories, we will misunderstand each other from the beginning to end. Now, those of you who were here last week are going to recognize a few minutes of the beginning of this. It'll get different later, so don't worry about that part. But I'll try to tell the best stories out of the first part.
They're all good.
That's good. So I can tell them all. We'll be here for 3 hours. Yeah, right. We're talking about creation stories. We are talking, I prefer to say, about origin stories. That's an important distinction, especially when you're dealing with stories from other cultures, because not all other cultures create the world with a creator. In the case of the stories we're looking at, there are creators in all of them. But origin story is still a term that I've come to prefer, because what we're talking about is the origin of what is. We are not simply focusing on the act of creating, and we're not looking simply at the how or the what or the mechanism, any of that, but we are, with all of these stories, looking at the origin of all that is. And that ends up being really important for what we're going to try to think about, because origin stories do not just narrate something that is supposed to have happened long, 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 long ago, and then was done happening. Origin stories, read properly, tell you the origin of everything that surrounds you normally, and tells you what the world is and how the world works, and tells you how you live in the world. Hang on to that, because origin stories tell you the origin of human being, the origin of nature's being, the origin of all being, and how we be, as an active verb, together. That is a piece that's going to matter, especially tomorrow. Let me tell you just a little bit about stories first, because it's crucial in American culture that you think briefly about what stories are, because American culture thinks of stories as rather foolish things, but meaning nothing positive by that. Rather flimsy things, and meaning something, in fact, flimsier than that when we talk about stories. American culture thinks of stories as mere things. I asked the group that was gathered here a week ago to pretend with me for the week that for at least our time together, there is no such thing as a mere story. That ends up mattering enormously. There's no such thing as a mere story. Stories do things that are essential to human life. Stories do things that are of incredible power. There are all sorts of places that we can go to think about that. Let's have coffee and talk about all 39 of them. But just one piece that I want to hand you. And it comes to me from Aristotle. Not a Christian, not a Jew. But he understood something about the functioning of stories that has been, for me, so formative that I hand it to my students and I'll hand it to you. Aristotle, in his Poetics, it's a piece about dramatic performed stories, particularly tragic dramas. But what he said about stories, talking about tragic dramas, applies, as near as I can tell, to every kind of narrative that I know anything about, and especially the kind of stories that we're talking about. Aristotle, in his Poetics, asked himself the question. If you've read Aristotle recently, you know he asks questions and then answers them in great detail, finely grained and carefully sorted and stacked at great length. In the Poetics, he asks himself a simple question. What is a proper drama? What's a proper narrative? And then, of course, having asked, he answers. A proper narrative is that which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That's all there is. That's what he says. The Poetics goes on at great length, but in fact, that is the most important thing that he says about the functioning of narrative in the entire Poetics. I tell my students who choke on Aristotle, which is, with Frosch, all of them, with sophomores, more than all of them sometimes, I tell my students that some year I'm going to require them to buy a rubber stamp with a single word on it, and the word is duh. And whenever they find something that is so flat-footed obvious that it just can't be important, they should stamp it with a duh stamp. And then when they go back to study for the exam or to prepare for the essay or do whatever they have to do next, the only thing they should read are things that have a duh stamped by them. Because there is, in Aristotle, a commitment to simple clarity that is important for students to learn. Pay attention to the things that seem obvious. He's going to do something striking with them. Always does. So, a proper narrative is that which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And now, you play the part of the duh stamp. One, two, three.
Duh.
Okay. Now, he says, what is a beginning? Ah, a beginning, says Aristotle, is that before which there is nothing and after which there is everything. One, two, three.
Duh.
And goes on, just because he wanted to make sure that everything gets nailed down and everything gets put in its pigeonhole and nailed there, Aristotle says, what might therefore an end be? An end is that before which there is everything and after which there is nothing. And on three, one, two, three, duh. But the most important thing of all about that is that Aristotle has just said something that is in fact profound. Because he has just said that a proper narrative is unlike real life. He has said that a proper narrative is an artifice. That is where the word artificial comes from. And what you've got to catch to understand Aristotle and to understand narratives at all is that when you're talking about narratives, according to Aristotle, it is a good thing to be artificial. Now, if America has trouble with mere story, just imagine the trouble we have with the idea that artificial is good. In America, if you say to someone that something tastes artificial, it's not a compliment to the cook. If someone says, your manner is rather artificial, they're not telling you they like the way you carry yourself in the world. In Aristotle, artifice is the benefit of narrative. Why? Because an artifice is something that has been shaped by an artist. And artists are necessary, says Aristotle, to make raw life something that human beings can think about. The raw rush of data, as Aristotle understands it, overwhelms us. And if we sink in it, we can't think at all. And as it rushes by us, it's simply chaotic and confusing. We can't make sense of it, notice the manufacturing metaphor, until we tell an artifice story. A story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. At about this point, when I am working with undergraduates, there are two people in the room who've had a course from me before, and they know that this is either true or I'm going to be so committed to it, they might as well pretend that they think it's true. And the rest of them think that I'm probably goofy. And 9 or 12 of them are wondering if it's too late to drop the course because they're being taught by a lunatic. That's a good thing to be wondering, and if that's about where you are, good for you. The thing about Holden is you can drop or not drop, but well, I'll be here tomorrow. Let me try to at least de-lunatic myself for you, and to de-lunatic Aristotle. I tell my students, a proper narrative, because it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, is unlike regular raw life. Because in regular raw life, there are no beginnings, and there are no ends. Now that sounds absolutely false to everyone, maybe to you also. Especially sounds false, I think, to my students. I teach many of them are 18 to 22 year olds. and therefore they think about beginnings and ends with a great deal of passion and a great deal of fervor, because a great many of them are thinking about the beginnings and ends of relationships. Of course. And therefore they think about the beginnings of relationships because they can remember the beginnings of relationships. So I tell them a story about me and my wife, who, when I meet her at the end of this week, she and I will have been married 33 years when I meet her. Right now we're only married 32 years. And so I tell my students, as of this weekend, my wife and I will be married 33 years. That must mean that our relationship started 33 years ago, right? Because one day I was walking down the street and I wandered accidentally into a building, discovered it was a church, thought it was a bowling alley, but there was up front a woman in a very beautiful white dress, and I thought I probably should marry her. Or not. No, of course, before the marrying is the engaging, and before the engaging is the dating, and before the dating is the meeting, and before the meeting is the noticing. All of that recedes further and further back. But surely, there's a first point where you meet someone. Well, it's a problem for me and my wife, because my wife was my sister's best friend since grade school. I have no idea when I met her. Not a single crumb of an idea when I met her. But I do know the first words I said to her. I was 2 years older, sitting in the lunchroom, senior in high school. My sister brought in several of her friends, I'm sure, because her cool older brother was having lunch that day, and she wanted them all to see me. I was positive of this, and there were chairs across from me at the table, and they came and sat down. My sister told me, "You aren't that cool." They came, they sat down, my future wife, sitting directly across from me at the table. I look at her and I think, I wonder who she is. I think I've seen her before. I don't remember why or when or where, but she looks vaguely familiar. I suppose it's because of my sister, but I don't know. But I look at her and I think, I'm supposed to be the cool older brother. I should say something suave, so I do. I look her in the eye and I say to her, "You should eat your cheese. It will make you constipated." And she married me anyhow. But if I tell you the story of our relationship and I start there, notice what that beginning does to the story. The rest of the story is going to be a story with lots of eye rolling and lots of occasions for my poor wife to say over and over again, "Yes, I do believe he said that. Yes, he does that all the time." That would be a true story of our relationship. Now, I could tell you the story of our relationship and start someplace else. I could start on our wedding day. We were married in Pipestone, Minnesota on June 21st in 1975. And if any of you happen to be in Pipestone, Minnesota on June 21st in 1975, you will know that it was in the afternoon, 98 degrees, and the humidity was about 97%. Fortunately, by the time our wedding happened at 7 in the evening, the temperature had gone down to 97 degrees, but there was now 98% humidity, so it sort of averaged itself out. Averaged itself out as blasted hot. We were standing up front. I was sweating. That was my contribution to the day. I was doing it very well, because you got to be good at something, and I'm really good at sweating. So I was standing there sweating, and I could feel the sweat running down my back, pooling up on my belt, and I was wondering, would it show through my brown velour tuxedo with the ruffled sleeves? Yeah, there are things that, for which there is no excuse, but we all wore those things. And I'm standing there wondering, does it show through or not? I don't know, because the wedding pictures, you couldn't tell. They were blurry. I also had my eyes shut in all of them. My father-in-law said, "You know, you want to ever get out of this, you could tell them you were asleep." But I'm standing there and I'm sweating. And I'm sweating and it's running down. I'm wondering if my wife is sweating. I'm hoping not, because her dress is surely hotter than my brown velour tuxedo. But we're all sweating. Our pastor is sweating too. And I notice that the sweat is, I'm a good sweater. I'm a really good sweater. But he's Olympic class sweating. It's dripping off his nose. Now, sweat doesn't usually drip off my nose. I find this fascinating. It's dripping off his nose over and over. And I've been reading chaos theory, and I knew that you cannot predict when the next drop will fall from a faucet of water that's dripping, because there are so many variables that the drip will come when the drip comes. And I don't know, I'm wondering, does it apply to noses? Some that are watching. When you're getting married, you have to keep yourself busy. If any of you who are not, just remember, keep yourself busy so you don't pass out. So I'm up there thinking about chaos theory and sweat dripping off our pastor's nose, and I'm counting, and I'm realizing it's true. I can't wait to tell my, well, she'll be my wife next time I get to talk to her about this. I can't wait to tell her. It's true. Chaos of theory applies to noses. And so I'm standing there and watching this. Now, this is 1975, and that means that we wrote our own wedding service. Because in 1975, the prescribed order of service for everyone to use was the red book, the service book and hymnal. And in the service book and hymnal, you had to say things that had ets and eths on the end of them, and I have a slight lisp. I cannot say those things without spitting on people, and you shouldn't spit on your wife-to-be. Even I know that. So we're standing there, and there are also lines in the thing like, and thereunto do I plight thee my troth. No one knew what a troth was or how you might plight one, so everyone wrote their own service. We had written a service, we had written a beautiful service, and we had worked with our pastor, we'd come up with the entire thing from one end to the other, created a beautiful service. He wrote it all down in little 3x5 cards, which was good because as soon as we got up there, I remembered nothing. I was counting his sweat drops. But he's got it all written down with his fountain pen in a washable blue ink. And about 2/3 of the way through the service, he looks down at his note card, and his eyes get whites all the way around, and he shows us the card, and it is an even blue wash. There's not a single readable word on the card. He says, "We're on our own, follow me." And from that moment on, he made up the service. He made up prayers, he made up vows, he made up a responsive reading. How do you make up a responsive reading and have it work? I have no idea, but he did it. When people got done, they said, "That was a beautiful service, best one ever." I said, "Yes, didn't we write a good one?" It might have been what we wrote, I couldn't remember. Now, if I started the story of our marriage there, it would be a story that involves a lot of improvising and a lot of sweating. And it would be a true story also. During the course of our wedding service, the temperature dropped 30 degrees because there was a major thunderstorm, tornadoes running around the county, hail, in fact, all sorts of things. And if you listen to the track tape of our wedding service, which of course we can't listen to, but trust me, it's on there. If we could listen to the 8-track tape of our wedding service still, you would hear the thunder and lightning drowning out all voices and all sorts. So I actually don't know what the responsive readings were because they were drowned out completely by thunder. If I started the story of our relationship there, it would be a story that involves thunder, some danger, and some indistinct speech that you wish you could have understood better. And it would be a true story. The thing that matters is those three stories would be different. They, in fact, would be quite different. They would intersect at all sorts of points because they pick up the same raw rush of data that makes up a human life and interpret it by selecting and weaving and telling. Aristotle said, "The value of artifice is that it takes the raw rush of data and it makes it into something that a human being can think about." Makes it into something intelligible, which should mean, English majors in the room, that you can intellige it. If it's intelligible, there should be a verb to intellige. Stories make it so that you can intellige the raw rush of data. Now that's important when you're looking at origin stories, because origin stories indeed have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the beginning is the beginning of all that is. Now, there's a lot more. We'll have coffee. We can talk. But what I want to talk about, especially this week, is a characteristic of these stories that we have inherited from the deep, deep, deep past. These stories that I learned to study, in fact, with Fred Geiser, sitting in classrooms, doing what people have done generation after generation after generation, which is sitting down and reading these stories and studying them closely. because that is how you respect the text. You study it until your eyes fall out. You put them back in and you study it closer and harder. You study it until you know it inside out, backwards, forwards, every which way you can. You know it in its original language. You know it in its several translated languages. You know it in its verb tenses. You know it in its anomalies. You know it as a text that you can study with all your might. This is an important faithful act, and one that Christians and Jews have been deeply involved in for millennia. Christians, surely, Jews even more so, study the text so thoroughly that a good yeshiva student is expected, in fact, to know large sweeping masses of the material, because having studied it so closely, it simply flows out. I met a fellow at a conference once who, if you asked him to start on a particular page of Talmud, specify the page, specify the paragraph, he could start there and recite until you told him to stop. I thought that was astonishing. He said, I was actually the runt of the litter. In his class, there was someone, if you told him a word on a page, on a paragraph, he could go backwards in order to the beginning, because it was studied and learned so thoroughly on the page that it was completely encompassed. Respectful, close study is something that Christians do in a pale imitation of Jews, but it is an amazing close study in either case. But I want to point out something important, and that is that this close textual study, requiring the reading of two languages to read Jewish scripture, plus how many languages do you want to see it translated into? Five, anyway. This close, careful textual study is a study that presupposes that these stories we're looking at are printed on a page. And it is worth noticing that in the first century of the Common Era, which is the era that I study more often, in the first century of the Common Era, estimates vary. But when people are being especially optimistic about how many people could read in a given community, they say 5%. I've heard people that say for elites, elite males, maybe 13%. 5% for overall communities. Some people say 3. Jewish literacy rates tended to be just a little bit higher. But even if we give them 7%, that would mean that in this room, how many could we have? We must have something like 50 people here. 7 out of 100 is 3.5 out of 50. So you can read, you can read, and you can half read. But the rest of us cannot at all. What does that mean? I'd like to ask you, pass this around and around. I've got 25, which means you kind of got to look a couple on, but find a way. You can at least see over a shoulder or across a shoulder or across an arm. What do you have in your hand?
It's music.
It's music. Funny, I didn't hear a thing.
That's a dumb joke.
What music? How many here can read music? Excellent. This is a far more literate crowd than an average American audience. I've done this for all sorts of audiences, and in fact, you often get only a few hands. I think some of it is that you are more courageous than many average American crowds, but some of it is many of you read music. Anybody know what that piece is? Is it Mozart? Why do you say?
The second line just sounds like something new.
Mozart, why?
Opera?
Horn concerto.
What's that?
Horn concerto.
Horn concerto, yes. Can you hear it? Yeah, tuning is a nice thing. Something that's going to be exceedingly important this whole week. This is not music, it is written music. It is essential. I don't think either of you has this learned by heart, especially since I asked them this morning. I don't think either of you has this memorized. So the essential written music was essential, but it wasn't music till you played it. Until you played it. Even for those of us that can look and hear the melody line and figure out what it must be, although having a French horn sitting here is sort of a dead giveaway. I should have faked them out. Those of us that can look and read, I can read the melody line and know what it is because we got a lot of hornists in our family, and the Mozart horn concerti are simply, it's the air we breathe. But I don't care to look at the music. I look at the music, I can make sense of it. But listening to it, something happens that doesn't happen when I look. Those of you who are better musicians than I, and that's not hard, could maybe look and hear also the accompaniment and hear and see the chord structure. People who have studied, like my yeshiva friend, can look and see much more than I. But does that compensate? Does that weigh equally with listening? What's the difference when you listened just now? Can you tell me what happened by you? Yeah.
It becomes live.
It becomes live. I love the way you say things. Because that's exactly right. It's there. It's all there. And if you've listened to this, and if I allowed you to know what piece it was so that you had some memory to help you, you could have remembered hearing Dennis Brain playing it on a recording, or you could remember hearing the last time you heard someone play it. But that's still not live. What else happened?
It draws the listener in and engages the listener with the artist.
How? Oh, 100 things. How does it engage you with the artist? It's your daughter, that helps. But no! But how does it engage you with the artist?
Well, it draws from this, it draws my senses.
Yes. Yes.
To the music, to the sound, to the ebb and flow.
And it does flow and it does ebb. And it does build tensions that it resolves. And at the end, it sits in a place that's a good stopping spot. And your ear and your body tells you that this is a nice place for it to finish. All of that happens when you hear it. You can look. You can do chordal analysis. It works great. You can tell. It's come back to tonic. Everything's good. But there's nothing like feeling it come back to rest.
Yeah. This isn't very poetic, but from a physics point of view,
yes,
the air in the room has changed. There are waves of sound coming through. The air in here is different.
Yes. And that is poetic, and that is crucial to the experience of music. Because I'm guessing that right now you can still hear Inga playing, because the air carried it. And the air is changed, and so are our ears. And now we're listening not just with our eyes, poor instruments of hearing, but also with our whole body, because you don't hear just with your ears, you feel it. Now where I'm sitting, I wasn't watching. I just was listening. But those of you that could watch have an engagement with the artists that goes beyond what I could have, because you can see what it takes. French horn doesn't blow itself. You, in fact, have to fill yourself, and you have to make choices, and you have to hold your embouchure, and you have to find a way to do all manner of things. And you get to see that, too, as part of this performance. I had planned to play Dennis Brain for you, and I've got him right here. It would have been wonderful. He was a magnificent hornist until he wrapped his car around a tree. It would have been terrific. But in fact, the room would not have been changed the way it has been now. Because you can see the physicality of the music. Anything else that struck you?
I have a friend who's an artist who argues that he's a visual artist, he's a sculptor. Argues that the work is changed by being participated in. He's a sculptor and he sculpts metal, and unlike museum pieces that have signs saying don't touch, he always put signs on his art that say please touch, because he thinks that it's important for people to feel directly involved and physically involved in his work, and it's important to him in that way.
If you want to read the technical background to that, read Truth and Method by Hans Georg Gadamer, G-A-D-A-M-E-R. Big honkin' book. Took me 2 years to read the sucker. But it is worth the effort, because Gadamer says exactly that. Every time you participate in a work of art, the work of art is changed by your participation. Any physicists in the room? Yes, that sounds like a Heisenberg principle. It is. He means that even when you participate in a sculpture that you're not allowed to touch, the sculpture is changed. Because you see it, you sense it, you hear it, you feel it at a point you have never heard it in your life before. I've listened to this piece, oh goodness, I have no idea how many years I've listened to this piece. 40? No more than that. And love it inside out, upside down and backwards. And every time it's different, because I never listened to it when I was 55 and nearly at my 33rd wedding anniversary before. I never listened to it before this instant, this way, this time. I can't wait until I'm as old as my parents. My dad's 85. Think how music must sound when you got 85 years of listening in you. I can't wait. Why does this matter? It matters because the stories that we're going to study this week are incomprehensible to most people that have only the text in front of them, the same way the music was inadequate for you until you heard it. We are literate, but that's That's not the same thing as hearing the music. For people that cannot read music, that piece that I handed you is dots and stripes, and that's all it is. They can be upside down, it can be sideways, it could be anyway. They can't read it no matter what you do with it. For the people in the ancient world who these stories first addressed, written text would have been dots and stripes for them too. But even for literate folk, these stories are dots and stripes until someone performs them. So why don't we? It's a good question, and it's not a question that's been asked with enough determination in the history of at least Christian biblical interpretation, because in fact, we do most of our interpretation textually. I will always do my interpretation textually, but over the last 10 years, I've learned that if you can just get a couple of musicians to play the dots and stripes, you learn something about the inside of the music of the story that you can't learn by just looking at the dots and stripes and analyzing them in seven languages and figuring out the tensions and the chords, the structure, and all the rest. Something happens when the story is performed that is essential to interpreting the story with any depth and adequacy. Does that mean we're going to act them out? Don't worry. It means we're going to look inside them using what you can learn through performance. We'll figure more out about that tomorrow. But let me say just a couple more things. One, all of these stories were performed in the ancient world. Even after they were written, they were performed. And performance was up through, in fact, oh goodness, all the way through the antique period altogether, performance was the primary mode of engagement. In the first century, people writing about texts and readers imagine that all reading takes place aloud with an audience. So performance, even in deeply textual society, still is essential to the reading of a text. All of these texts were performed that way. But even more important than that, all of these stories were composed orally at their outset. These stories are not the product of someone at a writing desk. These stories are the product of a process of storytelling that was later committed to writing. It might have been committed to writing very early. It might have been committed to writing almost immediately, but these stories show every sign of oral composition. There are oral structuring characteristics, there are linguistic characteristics, there are repetitive structures, there are keywords. There are things that to an eye of someone who studies oral performance, these stories show signs of having been orally composed. What's that mean? It means that somewhere, somehow, sometime, the first time Genesis 2, which we're going to spend most of our time on, came to life, it came to life out of someone's mouth. They may be recorded even immediately. I don't think so, but maybe. But it came to life out of someone's mouth. These stories were performed. That's particularly true of the story that kicked Genesis 1 and 2 into motion. Because the story that I'm going to hand you when you leave was a story that was performed in the streets of Babylon every year in the course of a 7-day festival celebrating the origin story and the ascension of the new prime deity. But let me tell you a story leading up to that. It's a story that many of you could tell as well as I, surely Fred. My dad could tell it better than I, because my father loves the old stories in Jewish scripture. When I was was a kid, my dad could tell. My dad even read Leviticus. My dad's weird. But this story is one that many could tell, but let me tell it to you. However Jewish people got to the land of promise, they were there in the year 1000 before the Common Era. However they got there, whatever ragtag way, they were there in the year 1000. And they were unified under a king. Whether the king was a good idea or not, the stories themselves argue. They were unified under their second king. First King Saul proved not so good at the job. At least so says David, his successor. David appears to have been skillful, and he pulled together a ragtag group of clans that had been bound together when they needed to be and otherwise not bound together hardly at all. He bound them together and held them under his authority as king. He ruled as king from Jerusalem, his city, not a clan city, one that he took and held, so that his authority was never beholden to any single clan. And he could rule over them, and did. David is remembered as the king of all kings, as a man after God's own heart, which the more I know about David, the more it makes you wonder about God. But he was a king who ruled and held a unified kingdom together. This period of unity, this golden age, lasted not so very long, because under David's descendants, the kingdom split. In 922, there was not one kingdom of the people of God, but two. A northern kingdom called Israel, a southern kingdom called Judah. But these two kingdoms understood themselves to be equally the heirs of Sarah and Abraham, understood themselves to be equally the possessors of the old story, understood themselves equally to be those who came out from Egypt and settled in the land of promise. And for the next 200 years, they lived next to each other and sometimes cooperated and sometimes didn't. Sometimes went to war with each other, sometimes didn't, sometimes helped each other. They lived next to each other, each with a king, each with the same old stories. They understood that they'd been brought there, each, by a God who had promised to give them a land, to make them a nation, and to make them strong. They understood themselves to be strong because of the activity of God. The fact that it had an awful lot to do with the major powers of the world being asleep at the time did not occur to them, as it never does to anyone when things are going well. But that is why they could grow, and did, and live stably. In the year 722, more or less, a major superpower, having awakened, looked around, stretched its muscles, and looked for someone to conquer. That's what superpowers do. They looked around, they looked to the east, didn't see anything especially interesting. They looked to the north, they didn't go there at all. They looked to the west and south and saw Egypt and thought, there's a place you could conquer, there's a place you could test yourself, and off they went, Assyria, rolling toward the other superpower. As it rolled over the petty kingdoms that had grown up, imagining themselves to be having a golden age. They just had never encountered an actual conquering army. Assyria was very good. When Assyria encountered Israel, it destroyed Israel. It destroyed its cities, it destroyed its armies, it destroyed the nation, it destroyed everything. And having finished the destruction, it lifted up the people and hauled them into exile. Assyria was very good at that, too. The aim was, the theory was, the principle was, that having been hauled into exile by Assyria, It would be scattered throughout Assyria's whole realm. The aim was, if you were the community in exile, to separate you so thoroughly that you would never again hear your native language. Now that surely didn't happen that way, but the aim was to disperse them so widely and then bring in people from elsewhere to settle these conquered lands so that their nation was utterly dispersed and destroyed and therefore not a threat. It worked. The 10 tribes, more or less, the math's a little fuzzy, the 10 tribes of the north vanished forever. How do you know they vanished forever? Because every 3 or 4 years, the Discovery Channel finds them again somewhere else. They can't be in North America, they can't be in China, they can't be in India and Africa all at the same time without having been utterly scattered. Assyria knew what it was doing. When Assyria rolled through and conquered Israel, it did not conquer Judah. Not because Judah was so powerful and almighty, but because Judah was so small. You can't swat all the mosquitoes in the woods. That's one of the rules you learn when you go canoeing. You can't swat all the mosquitoes. They didn't swat that one because they didn't need to. Judah reacted to the disaster the way people react to disasters all the time. The first thing they said when they saw their cousins destroyed was some sort of gasp of horror and amazement. And when they discovered that they were still alive, despite having been in close proximity to the most brutal superpower available, they gasped in astonishment. And they thanked God in that incoherent way that anyone thanks God when something happened that should have killed them but didn't this time. And after they gasped and thanked God, they tacked their lives together as well as they could and went on. If you've ever listened to anyone, or if you've ever not died when you could have, you maybe have noticed that there's a regular progression to how people's understanding of that event changes. Very quickly, after not dying when you could have, people frequently will say something like, I'm going to make something of my life. I have my life, I have breath in my body, I owe something to God and the world. I will give back and I will live in a way that honors the fact that I inexplicably escaped. I will do something. Doesn't take long and that morphs into something like, I have a purpose. God has given me a purpose. God kept me alive and I will live for that purpose. It doesn't take long and that morphs into something like, God kept me alive because I have a purpose. It doesn't take long and it morphs into something all too often like, God killed them but kept me alive because I was more promising. Now at this point, it's been sour and rotten for a long time, and it doesn't get there quickly, but it does get there with some regularity. Just listen, I was 6 years a working preacher, and I heard people get there even in just 6 years sometimes. After a while, Judah started telling itself the story that the reason that they had not been destroyed was because they were in possession of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was the holy city, and God would not allow it to suffer damage. And in the holy city was the temple, and God would not allow it to suffer damage, because the temple was the place where God's finger touched the earth and held it still in the middle of all the chaos that surrounded everything, and God would never take God's finger away from the earth. So the fact that God's finger held the world still at the temple meant that we have the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, and we will never be touched. There were people that believed such, not everyone surely. You can't ever get everyone to be that stupid. But you can get a lot of people to be stupid enough. And just because of the relief, they believed it. And they got away with believing it until the year, roughly, 587. Because a little bit before that, the next superpower awoke, Babylon. Stretched itself, having emerged from a civil war. It's the same area as Assyria. It's the different tribal groups slightly, but they're all interrelated. Stretched itself and decided to go roaring off toward Egypt and encountered petty kingdom after petty kingdom and crushed them. And when it encountered Judah, it crushed Judah. It starved the city into submission. When Fred was telling the stories this morning, the ache of those days, what it does, what starvation does to a city, what it causes to break down, what it teaches you about the what desperation does to human beings and to human communities. The Jews living in Judah, inside Jerusalem, starving, learned. You do not learn those lessons without being changed forever. And they were. The walls were broken down. The city was leveled. The temple was destroyed. Before that, of course, the last independent king, Zedekiah, escaped with his retainers through the walls, imagining that they might sneak through the Babylonian army. Their attempt was not so successful. And the last independent king saw his sons slaughtered before his eyes, and then his eyes were gouged out. So that his last visual memory was of his boys on their knees crying for their mother. And the Babylonians hauled those who survived into exile. Now, the Babylonians had learned a thing or two. They'd studied. They were astute students of history. They knew what Assyrians had done, lifting up entire populations. They knew that it worked very well. They also knew that it was labor-intensive and very difficult to do and quite expensive. And they realized, having paid careful attention, that you don't have to do that to pacify a conquered area. All you need to do is lift the leaders. So they took the leaders, military leaders that were still alive, they took political leaders that were still alive, they took business leaders, artistic leaders, religious leaders, all leaders down to the level of middle management, leaving behind only people that had never been elected treasurer of the seventh grade class. People that had never been in charge of anything were left behind. They took the leaders, hauled them off to Babylon. Not because they were merciful, no, they just knew it worked. Leaving behind people that were only too glad to receive governors who would provide order for them. When they hauled the leaders into exile, there emerges the second important difference between the Babylonian and Assyrian exilic practice. And that is that the Babylonians, unlike the Assyrians who had dispersed the exiles throughout their realm, Babylonians gave them the option of living in a coherent community, Jews in a Jewish community. Now, they encouraged them not to. They, in fact, encouraged them to join the most powerful nation on earth. They encouraged them to join this technologically superior and obviously culturally superior nation. They encouraged them to become part of the next new world, because, of course, that's what you can offer people when you've conquered them. You encourage them to become part of your side. And some Jews will have done that because it made some sense. They had seen how able they had been to defend themselves. It hadn't been impressive. But other Jews decided not to take them up on their offer, and decided to live in Jewish communities. So, you are the Jewish community in exile. What shall we do? We've been given the offer to meld ourselves into Babylonian society, and we decided to say, in a famous quotation from the Battle of the Bulge, nuts. What shall we do? Having said nuts, you have to come up with an actual program. Here we are. What should we do?
Make a government.
Sorry?
Make a government.
Make a government. We need to have some sort of community organization. We don't know how much the Babylonians will let us do, but you can't have a community without a community organization. We've got to have some sort of coherent structure.
Very good. First plan. What's next?
How do you create an identity? Because we will need that. You cannot have a community without some sort of a common unity in it. And common unity is somehow related to identity. How shall we do that? What does identity spring from?
History and tradition.
History and tradition. That means that tradition, first of all, we will live here as we lived there. If I forget you, O Zion, may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I do not set you above my highest joy, let my right hand wither. Got it out of order, but it's all there. Psalm 137. We will live here as we lived there. Which, by the way, if any of you come from recent immigrant families, as I do, you know that that's what those exiles did as well. In my mother's house. My mother's first language is Swedish. They spoke Swedish until my mother went to school, but they ate and lived Swedish all their lives because it was a way of remembering the tradition and maintaining an identity that allowed them to be who they were. What about history? How do you maintain history? Tell the stories. And to whom? Well, to each other for sure.
The children.
To the children especially. And you got to do all of it at once. You got to tell the stories so that the children hear them and so that we hear them. And anyone else have the experience, if you had kids, of relearning the stories you used to know? And they're better, bigger, and more interesting? I loved it. I got to go back to all the things that I had slipped loose for me. And we learn them. You tell the stories to the kids so that you can hear them coming out of your mouth. And if your family is like my family, the grandmas tell the stories to the kids so that the parents can sit there and say, I remember when you sang me that song when I was a little boy. My father loves poetry. My mother grew up in Western New York. And we like to say my father grew up in the 19th century. Northern Minnesota without plumbing, without electricity, without telephone, without radio. What they had was a piano and poetry. My father knows poems. When he was in the last years of his career, we realized that my father knew so many poems that he'd spoken to us as children, and we didn't know any of them. So we said, Dad, when you're out doing farm visits, why don't you take a tape recorder along and just record the poems that you know? And we figured, you know, we'll get a bunch of poems. We got 614. And he said, you know, I only recorded the ones that I could remember all of. There are others, if I'd looked them up, I could have remembered them too. But I just remember the ones, I just recorded the ones that I could remember straight off. It was such fun listening to them because then I could tell them to our kids. And I could have my dad tell them to our kids because then I would remember when my dad put me to bed, he told me this poem all the time. You tell the kids the stories because it gives you an identity. You preserve your language. You preserve your customs. You preserve whatever you can of your sense of God. That sense of God will have been hit by a truck. But if you're going to preserve who you are, you hold whatever bloody pulp is left of your core theology, and you figure out what could grow from it. The Jewish community in exile did all of this and more. Tomorrow, and we meet at 6:15 tomorrow, we will look at something that pushed against them and might have destroyed them and and may have saved them. We're going to look at, here it is, the story told about how the world came to be, the story told in Babylon. We're not looking at the whole thing. We're looking only at the Marduk and Tiamat part. I have, again, 25 copies, so if you can take as many as there are, we can maybe get some more copies. Hang around after if you'd like one. We'll run up and zip some up. But bring them back tomorrow so we don't have to cut down all the trees in the forest. Thank you very much. I love it.